This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One new book that might be of interest is Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change by Ashley Dawson. In Extreme Cities, Ashley Dawson argues that cities are ground zero for climate change, contributing the lion's share of carbon to the atmosphere, while also lying on the front lines of rising sea levels. Today, the majority of the world's megacities are located in coastal zones, yet few of them are adequately prepared for the floods that will increasingly menace their shores. Instead, most continue to develop luxury waterfront condos for the elite and industrial facilities for corporations. These not only intensify carbon emissions, but also place coastal residents at greater risk when water levels rise. In Extreme Cities, Dawson offers an alarming portrait of the future of our cities, describing the efforts of Staten Island, New York, and Shishmaref, Alaska residents to relocate, Holland's models for defending against the seas, and the development of New York City before and after Hurricane Sandy. Our best hope lies not with fortified seawalls, he argues. Rather, it lies with the urban movements already fighting to remake our cities in a more just and equitable way. Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change by Ashley Dawson. Out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Since Bernie Sanders' mind-expanding success in the 2016 Democratic primary, much of the left, from progressive Democrats to socialists, have had their sights set on something we had long, at least implicitly, assumed was impossible: state power and governing. The question now is how to take power, and the left is consumed by debates, mostly but not always productive, about how and whether to engage with the Democratic Party, or, in a more limited fashion, with the Democratic Party's ballot line. My guest today is Joe Dinkin, the National Campaigns and Communications Director at the Working Families Party. We'll talk about just what to do with the Democratic Party, and recent successes and failures running left candidates for office since the 2016 election. Before we get to the show, a reminder that we're trying to reach 700 supporters on Patreon.com by the year's end. If you haven't yet, please go to patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. And toss us a little cash. Under socialism, all rides will be free. But for now, we need our listeners to pay us money via the website patreon.com. Thanks. On to the show. Joe Dinkin, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
Before we get into depth about all the work you've been up to recently and where you're heading, for listeners who don't know, what is the Working Families Party?
So the Working Families Party is a national grassroots progressive political organization, and we see it as our mission to recruit, train, and elect the next generation of progressive leaders to office, and then work with progressive elected officials to fight for economic and racial and social justice and pass public policies that make a meaningful difference in the lives of working people. I'll give an example of what we do from New York City, where we were founded in 1998. We're founded in 98 by a group of progressive unions and community organizations and progressive elected officials who saw the Democratic Party under Bill Clinton as beginning to move too far to the right under the third way DLC era with between NAFTA and welfare reform and a Democratic Party that was chasing Wall Street money because of the view that they could be competitive in politics with Wall Street money and neglect progressives, neglect the left, neglect people of color. So I'll give you an example from New York City. Just looking back 10 years ago in New York City, our mayor was a billionaire and our city council was dominated by a handful of old Democratic Party machines who were heavily dominated by the real estate industry for funding. Today, we have a much more progressive mayor whose base is in the labor movement and in communities of color, and a city council where the biggest faction is the Progressive Caucus, which was, a group of council members who back in, 2007 and 2008, the Working Families Party began a new program of recruiting a new kind of candidate to office, often people who had come out of community organizing groups or housing rights groups or unions, and giving them the tools and skills to run for office, challenging those Democratic machines, challenging candidates backed by the real estate industry. In 2009, we elected the first class of them, and that group of members went on to form the Progressive Caucus. In 2013, won a bunch more seats, and those members together formed the Progressive Caucus on the New York City Council, where the dynamic now in New York City is actually, instead of being like it is in most of America, a fight between moderate Democrats and right-wing Republicans, it's actually a fight between Democrats and progressives. And that's the fight that we want to see in America. And so our vision of success really looks like building the political power for working people and for communities of color and for progressives to be able to affect that dynamic in cities and states all over the country. We want to help Democrats win back majorities in state legislatures, but we also want to make sure those majorities are dominated by progressive forces, not by conservatives and moderates and business-backed candidates.
And you've been involved for how long?
I started the Working Families Party in 2004, so a little more than 13 years now.
And how did you get involved initially?
So I sort of took a summer job in 2004. I was a film student at the time, and the only summer jobs I could find were organizing at the Working Families Party or unpaid internships in documentaries. And the unpaid internships weren't actually going to pay my rent to be able to live in New York City that summer. So I took the organizing job. But if I'm being honest, I was pretty cynical about politics. I was a little bit of a ideologue, but I didn't really think the real world practice of politics was something that I could see a path to making much of a difference, in the post September 11th America, in, which I had increasingly felt conservative and pro-military. And I didn't really feel like I had a good outlet for meaningful, concrete political expression. But I found myself in this job at the Working Families Party, working on a campaign to raise the minimum wage back in 2004. The minimum wage was $5.15 an hour.
My job was in
New York State. That's right. Actually, that's, the fight for 15 has been so meaningful for me because the minimum wage was sort of the issue that got me engaged in politics for the first time. My job at the time was leading crews of canvassers out every day to door knock in Long Island and Westchester County suburbs, mostly Republican state Senate districts, and generating handwritten letters from constituents to their Republican state senators. But we had a Republican governor, a Republican-controlled state Senate, and cynical is kind of cool at 20. I didn't really think there was much of a chance of accomplishing anything. I'll cut a long campaign short and say that, we ultimately won the campaign to raise the minimum wage. We succeeded not only in forcing the Republican state Senate to vote to raise the minimum wage, but actually got them to vote again to override the veto of the Republican governor, Pataki, at the time, to raise the minimum wage. And I sort of realized, wow, power is a real thing. And I was with a crew of my canvassers in a Dunkin' Donuts in downtown Brooklyn when I got the call that we had succeeded, that the override vote was going to happen in the state Senate. I told all my canvassers about this exciting win, that we were going to raise the minimum wage in New York. And the Dunkin' Donuts workers heard me, and one of them actually started crying and told us about how a higher minimum wage would change her life. And that sort of changed my life, too. So, I've been doing that ever since.
That was like your Road to Damascus moment.
That's right.
Zooming back a more than a decade into the future, to the recent past, I want to talk about some of the races that WFP has been involved in. One that my listeners will be familiar with is Larry Krasner, who is now the Democratic nominee for district attorney in Philadelphia. And he won that race in May, and it was just one of the most incredible insurgent candidacies for local office that I've ever even heard about in the U.S., especially because we're talking about the job of top prosecutors, which pretty much anywhere traditionally, and in Philadelphia in particular, have often been occupied by people who are utterly comfortable being complicit in the perpetuation of mass incarceration and impunity for police abuses. So tell me a little bit about the Krasner race and WFP's involvement in it.
So I'll take a step back first and say that I think Larry is part of a trend that we're seeing across America this year. Larry's one of the best examples of the trend, but the trend is of progressive candidates, often people tied to social movements and progressive organizing groups, running for office who might have never really considered running before and running on bold and transformative platforms. Yeah, that
this
might
wasn't Larry's
out of the
secret, secret long-range plan.
That's right. Larry never knew that he was a candidate in the making. But, you know, Larry's claim to fame before running for office, his biggest spot in the public eye was he was the lawyer for the Black Lives Matter movement. He was the guy who used to get Black Lives Matter and ACT UP and Occupy Wall Street protesters out of jail. And I think you're totally right when you talk about the what a sea change it was to see somebody like Larry win in Philadelphia. You know, for the longest time in America, through the entire age of the war on drugs, through my whole childhood and, you know, youth, the people who were running for district attorney and winning were the people running by pledging to be the toughest on crime, by pledging to be the meanest to people who'd broken the law, this sort of chest-beating war on drugs mentality, where the best way to be a DA was to lock up as many bad guys as possible. And I really credit the Black Lives Matter movement for dramatically changing public perception of the broken system of criminal justice, of racially biased policing, of the existence of mass incarceration in America to a degree that I think a lot of people had never really understood before that movement, and into that very
it's awoken a lot of people from the kind of center to the left to it, and it's also kind of it's been kind of like an interesting polarizing experience, which has dangers and a lot of possibilities. You know, Trump won off of this
right.
anti-BLM backlash in many ways, I think. But
yeah.
from more mainstream everyday liberals who might have been copacetic with mass incarceration previously, that's now become something that's rightfully toxic. And in a city like Philly, there's really this opportunity there.
And, you know, it was less than 10 years ago that Lynn Abraham was the district attorney in Philly, somebody who had the nickname Queen of Death for the frequency with which she sought the death penalty. But 10 years later, you know, today, into this very different environment, I think transformed largely by the Black Lives Matter movement, Larry Krasner walks, and suddenly the context of the race with Larry in the front of the pack is, instead of who can be the toughest and the meanest, it's who can't, you know, there's a much more widespread understanding about a criminal justice system and mass incarceration system that is overly punitive, way too expensive, and fundamentally not working, not doing the job that it's supposed to do of keeping people and communities safe. And into that atmosphere, Larry Krasner walks, and the question of the race is who's best suited to actually make those transformations, to actually tackle the broken criminal justice system and make structural changes to it. And Larry, the guy who's been saying that for 30 years, is suddenly a man of the moment instead of a man out of step with the majority, which, you know, he might have felt like if he had tried to run 20 or 30 years ago.
And it was the situation of all of his primary opponents, you know, these creatures of the establishment tripping over themselves to try to catch up to him, but they couldn't because he actually had an authentic track record speaking on these issues and acting on these issues.
Right. And you know, it was incredible. The formula for his win was actually raising turnout, and in particular, spiking turnout among young people, among the people who have been kind of most radicalized by the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, voters under 30 turnout almost tripled compared to the, you know, 2013 election, which was just incredible to see. So, you know, the Working Families Party in Pennsylvania was one of Larry's very first endorsements, worked closely with him to develop his, you know, outreach and political strategy and field strategy and policy. We think of ourselves as the people who want to provide those sets of skills and trainings and resources to the candidates who really espouse the values that we want to see represented in public life. We also engaged in what's called an independent expenditure through the, you know, our national organization ran an independent expenditure that in the final 3 weeks of the election knocked on about 70,000 doors to identify Krasner supporters and draw them out to the polls. But, you know, I think Larry had the foresight to get into the race, had the, you know, observation how much sort of public sentiment and history had changed, and ran a really great campaign. And we saw it as our role to step up and help people like that, do everything we can to make sure they win. And actually, it's one of a handful of very exciting results around the country over the last year or two that really confirmed the sea change in how people are seeing the role of DAs and the you know, depressing state of our criminal justice system.
WFP is also been involved in a number of local races that have seen Black progressives elected in cities in the Deep South. One is Randall Woodfin, who recently won the race for mayor in Birmingham.
And yeah, by a bigger margin than anybody. You know, I think people projected that to be a very close race. He ultimately won by a pretty healthy margin.
Will you say a little about him and who he is? And
yeah, you know, Randall was a school board member who's, you know, candidate who had on the school board been sort of the leading fighter against privatization of public education, which is a fight that is roiling cities across America right now, with a very well-funded, you know, movement backed heavily by hedge funds seeking to make education work just like markets, where there are winners and losers, innovation and profit to be made. And we fundamentally believe something different, which is that you can't have losers in the education system. You actually have to have standards that are high enough for everybody to get the kind of quality education that allows them to be full citizens, full participants in public life, to have, you know, decent chances in life. And so Randall Woodfin challenged the incumbent mayor and ran in support of a $15 minimum wage, ran in support of in strong opposition to privatizing public education and on his record on that. And, you know, what WFP did was, you know, we actually had volunteers phone banking and texting voters in the district as, you know, one of the most interesting races in America. We actually had even some volunteers far beyond Alabama participating in it to help a, you know, bold candidate taking on a powerful incumbent like that win. And we were, you know, really pleased to see his victory, and we're excited to see what comes. And I also think, you know, I'll note that there's a contested Senate race coming up in Alabama too, where, you know, under ordinary circumstances, it might be unthinkable to imagine beating a Republican in the in an Alabama Senate race in such a deep red state. But I think the enthusiasm that we saw from this very recent election in Birmingham might mean that there's an opportunity for progressives and African-American communities to turn out at great enough numbers to actually put that race in serious play. One poll recently showed that race is tied.
And do you think that's because of Alabama liberals and leftists being energized about Roy Moore's just totally toxic, noxious, disgustingness, or is it that combined with more establishment Republicans being disinclined to head to the polls for him and thus creating more of an opening for the left?
You know, I would say that the baseline of Alabama is so deeply slanted Republican that it takes a lot of factors to make a race suddenly be polling even. But I think enthusiasm among progressives, I think divisions among Republicans, I think reaction to Trump, I think the extremism of the Republican nominee are all pretty good reasons that make this race look like one that there's an outside chance of winning.
Well, that would be remarkable. He's easily one of the worst human beings in this country. Nearby in Jackson, Mississippi, Chakwe Antar Lumumba won.
Sure.
Also
somebody. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's at the lead of a really remarkable political movement there that was led by his father previously, who tragically died in office. If you could say a little bit about the situation in Jackson for listeners who aren't aware of it.
So Chakwe Antar Lumumba's father was elected mayor actually 4 years ago, served less than a year before tragically dying. The son, Chakwe Antar Lumumba, actually ran for mayor after his father died and lost. Lost to the sort of establishment pick. I think the pattern that people expected in this municipal cycle was that Lumumba might come in first among the pack. The way the election worked in Jackson was it's a top two race, so every candidate in the field would run in the first round, and then the top two would go ahead into a runoff. And I think the prevailing, the conventional wisdom in Jackson was that in a crowded field, Lumumba might be able to cobble together 30 or even 40% and come in first in the first round. But he was, too radical. And the establishment and the Democratic Party and, business money would all unite around whoever the other candidate making it into the runoff was, making it impossible for him to win. Well, Lumumba surprised everybody by beating 50% in that first round and averting a runoff altogether. It was pretty remarkable. And I think it's also part of the surge we're seeing in the appetite of voters to be open to much bolder and much more transformative solutions. And it shows that when political leaders are actually putting forward ideas that make people believe that they can really make a change, make a difference in their lives, that people have a much bigger reason to go out to vote. So the same way that Larry Krasner drove turnout in Philadelphia by talking about the system of mass incarceration that was affecting so many young people, and in particular so many young people of color, Lumumba talked about the problems that are actually common among majority minority cities that have seen unbelievable disinvestment. And he talked about solutions that are ordinarily not seen as even on the table of mainstream debate in America broadly, around public ownership and around cooperatives and around some very interesting and cutting edge economic ideas to develop collective ownership and wealth and infrastructure in a city that's seen so much capital flight.
Yeah, I should do an entire show on what they're up to down there, because it comes, I don't know much about it, but it comes out of a long Black radical tradition in the area. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's a movement that, was at least 20 or 30 years in the making. But I think the leadership of Chakwe Antar Lumumba, the new mayor, of his sister Rukia Lumumba, and of a whole, cohort of young and old leaders who were pursuing this very, transformative and radical politics and actually won. I think it's one of the most interesting experiments to be watching and trying to replicate in other parts of the country. Just for our part, I'll say that we were endorsing early, and what we were able to provide was, expertise on field organizing that comes from our many years of campaign experience, that we were able to provide, door knocking capacity, basically capacity and strategy that, I wouldn't in any way try to take credit away from the incredible work of folks in Jackson. But we saw it as our duty to be part of the movement and to support somebody as potentially transformative as Chakwe, and do everything we could to help him win.
We just discussed some examples of how left candidates can win in the Deep South. but those examples were places in the Deep South that were already Democratic strongholds with large Black populations. I want to shift gears and ask you about how left candidates can win in Trump country more generally. And
sure. And I'll give, yeah, go ahead.
Well, one interesting case of this that I actually hadn't followed closely at the time was Christine Pellegrino, who in May won a special election for a New York State Assembly seat on Long Island, and she won that really decisively in a district that Trump had just a few months prior won decisively. So can you tell me a little bit about what happened there?
Christine Pellegrino is a teacher, an activist in her teachers union. She's been a leader in the opt-out movement and really got the political bug for the first time. Do I need to explain the opt-out movement?
Yeah, just briefly.
It's a movement of teachers and parents against the culture of high-stakes standardized tests dominating education curriculums and education spending. And so it was a movement of students that's taken hold in a lot of parts of the country, but is particularly robust in some parts of Long Island around getting students to say that they don't want to participate in those tests. And it's been quite powerful. And that was, you know, a lot of Christine Pellegrino's organizing experience. In 2016, she became deeply involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign and was eventually a delegate to the DNC for Bernie, and really got the political bug and began to think of herself as somebody who would want to be engaged in, you know, public office, engaged in making change in that level, maybe in helping to run somebody else's campaign. She went to a candidates training that the Working Families Party held on Long Island for progressives thinking about running for office back in, I think, March or April of 2017, not expecting, you know, a race to sort of present itself in her community so quickly. But there's a race opened up, a special election was called for the state assembly seat in which she lived. The local Democratic establishment in Suffolk County had been pushing for a different candidate, had sort of all but given up on the race because they didn't think that a district that Trump had won by 20 points was even worth really contesting. They just decided on a party loyalist, basically, to be their standard bearer for that race. Ultimately, the Working Families Party and some of the networks of Bernie volunteers and the teachers union prevailed on the local Democrats, succeeded in having them nominate Christine Pellegrino for the race, because we believed that only somebody who was capable of generating enthusiasm and inspiring voters with a message for how we could, you know, actually tackle some of the changes that were some of the challenges that we're facing, could compete and could drive the kind of turnout it would be necessary to win that race. So we were right. Christine ran an unbelievable campaign that brought in huge numbers of volunteers from the from teachers from across the state, Working Families Party volunteers, a huge mass of, you know, alums from the Bernie campaign sort of flooded into the district and, talked to a huge number of voters, turned people out, dragged people to the polls, and won this race that nobody saw coming. It was a swing from a district that Trump had won by 20 points to electing Christine Pellegrino by, I think, 19. So it was nearly a 40-point swing in her direction in just about 6 or 7 months.
That's remarkable.
I'll add one other quick thing, which is that same theory that it's progressive candidates who can inspire voters to pay enough attention, to engage enough, to want to turn out, to care about the race, to win, that has, you know, gives us a lot of faith for candidacies like Randy Brice, the Iron Stash, who you may have also followed a little bit. He's the union iron worker and Working Families Party member running for Congress in Wisconsin against Paul Ryan. Early polling has shown it's going to be a very competitive race in a race that Democrats didn't even seriously contest last time.
That would be just the most incredible thing that I've ever experienced if that happens.
In the last quarter, I hate to sound like one of the horrible mainstream political reporters who cares more about fundraising numbers than policy ideas. But in the last quarter, Randy Brice raised more than $1 million, almost entirely from small dollar grassroots donors in Wisconsin and across the country, beating Paul Ryan by about $600,000 on the quarter.
These are the Pellegrino's race plays to the left Berniecrat argument that the way to win elections against Republicans is to run unabashedly left candidates making clear arguments about why transformative policies need to be enacted that will concretely improve regular people's lives. But there were also two special congressional elections this year in that played in different ways to this ongoing debate between the Berniecrat left and the corporate-aligned Clintonite establishment in the party. And one was in Montana and the other was in Georgia, and they were both to fill vacancies for Trump cabinet members. And in Montana, Berniecrat Rob Quist ran and lost, and in Georgia, centrist John Ossoff ran and lost, and people on the Berniecrat left were hoping that Quist would win in right-leaning Montana and demonstrate that the left's argument is correct, and centrists were hoping that Ossoff would win in Georgia and prove that you have to run these milquetoast centrists in right-leaning districts to beat Republicans, and neither race really shook out for either side. What's your take on those races?
You know, those were two races that were in deep red Trump country. You know, part of appointing cabinet secretaries is that you get to choose who they are and where they come from. And in all cases, they were from strongly Republican-leaning districts. And I actually think in all cases, the closeness of the race, you know, spells trouble for Trump and Ryan and McConnell and the Republicans going into 2018. Ultimately, neither strategy proved to be quite enough to beat the Republicans in deep red districts. You know, my belief is in races like either of those that progressives have something like a moral obligation to do everything we can to cripple the ability of the Trump administration to continue to do so much harm to so many people. And I think those two races don't really tell us that much, except that I think that fight that you mentioned between you know, the sort of progressives and the more centrist wing of the Democratic Party will continue to kind of be at each other's, you know, at each other's throats for time to come without conclusive proof. You know, our view continues to be that progressives do better in these races, progressives have the ability to convey to voters that they really believe what they're saying, have the ability to inspire turnout and engagement, and also have the benefit of when they win, we actually have a progressive in office. So, you know, we're more likely to focus time on those progressives. But ultimately, I think we all need to do anything we can to defeat the unified Republican government we have in Washington right now, because, you know, it threatens so much.
In short, Bernie would have won. I haven't said that in weeks on this show, so I just had to get that in.
You should have one of those little meters that counts down the days since you've said it.
We were just talking about this debate between the Berniecrat Democratic Party left and the corporate-aligned Clintonite Democratic Party establishment. There's also a debate of sorts between the Democratic Party Berniecrat left on the one hand and the wide spectrum of people on the socialist left on the other over how and whether to engage the Democratic Party. And WFP typically flexes its muscle to back left candidates in Democratic primaries. And we do have a two-party system, unfortunately, so that makes sense to me on some level. But also maintains independence and sometimes runs people outside the Democratic Party line. What's your overall take on this debate and on what the right approach is?
You know, I think that the Democratic Party is the playing field more than it is a, you know, it's a piece of infrastructure that can be mobilized by lots of different forces more than it is any specific ideology tied to it. I think we do live in a deeply broken, imperfect political system that doesn't well represent the variety of political views we have in America. But you know, given single member districts and the high cost of, you know, running for office and you know, first past the post election rules, there are a lot of things we could do to make that better. But given the system we have, you know, parties in America are not really like parties in the rest of the world in that they don't really have fixed or consistent ideologies. But what they do have is ballot access. And in most cases, you know, we try to be strategic, and when we want to elect people who we think will carry our values in public office, most of the time in most of the country, it's a lot easier to do that within the context of a Democratic primary than as a, you know, sort of minor party candidate who might face some of those structural problems that I named before, like, you know, the first past the post system, which ultimately points heavily in the direction of a two-party system. When you have first past the post, there's heavy incentives for people to, you know, sort themselves into two big categories. That said, when there are times that there isn't a candidate running in the Democratic field who suits our values, there certainly have been times where we've run outside of that and beat the Democrats head on running as a Working Families Party candidacy. I think the places where we've been able to do that are mostly places where we've built up the most reliable voting base and activist base over time by engaging in elections strategically, by engaging in elections that people see a meaningful path to change rather than, you know, inviting people to participate in politics as symbolism. We think politics really affects people's lives, and we don't tend to engage in it as symbolism only. So, you know, just this year, in the city of Hartford, we ran a Working Families Party candidate named Josh Hall against a Democratic nominee. In this case, you know, we probably would have competed in a Democratic primary under normal circumstances, but there wasn't a primary because there was a, you know, the election structure in this case was a special election, which allowed the Democratic committee of Hartford, basically the Democratic town committee, to pick the candidate of their choice. They picked a party loyalist, and in a strongly Democratic district like this one, you know, it's a Democratic stronghold. They didn't think there was much of a race on their hands, and they weren't very worried about it. They picked a party loyalist, and we realized we couldn't get that guy to basically tell us his positions on anything, including, you know, whether he supported a $15 minimum wage, whether he supported the, you know, where he stood on the very contentious fights going on in the state capitol over privatization of public education, over the growth of charters. We couldn't get him to tell us what he believed. And so we ran an independent Working Families Party candidate and ultimately succeeded in that race, electing Josh Hall, who was a, you know, teacher and a union activist running on an unabashed progressive message of fair funding for all public schools, investing in public education, $15 minimum wage. And you know, even with the structural barriers facing outsider candidates, he was able to win. And then the other thing that I'll add is a lot of these places where we've succeeded in running a minor party only candidate and winning, it's in geographies where the Democratic Party is so dominant that the issue of, you know, spoilers doesn't loom quite as large in people's mind, because there was no earthly way in the north end of Hartford that a Republican candidate might accidentally win if a Democrat and a progressive WFP candidate divided the vote on the left or on the center and left, or however you want to think about it. There was no Republican candidate in the race. And so that structure, in our view, has often made it easier to elect independent Working Families Party candidates. And so often it's about becoming not the third party, but in places that are so single party dominated that there is effectively no Republican Party, it's allowed us to become the second party and compete.
How do you think that WFP's approach compares to that of DSA's, which is obviously very nascent, so it's hard to say what DSA's approach is because it's still being debated and developed. Do you see it as in contention with DSA's approach or more complementary? The approach I see being developed in DSA is like WFP. It's an instrumentalist relationship to the Democratic Party, but maybe a little more instrumental in the sense of seeing the Democratic Party ballot line more crudely just as a ballot line and hostilely seizing it to run open socialists. How do you see the two approaches?
You know, that's a good question. I'm really eager to see the new energy that's in DSA, and I'm curious, you know, watching pretty closely to see how their political practice develops. I think we broadly agree, you know, I think I agree with the idea of the Democratic Party ballot line as a sort of piece of infrastructure that you can seize in, you know, sort of more or less hostile terms. And I guess I would just say I'm eager to see how the DSA thinking develops. I think we are, you know, I mentioned up at the towards the top of the show that we, you know, want to see, we believe that a plausible outcome to change is, you know, Democrats in the majority in legislatures and progressives in the majority in those Democratic caucuses. We think that's a plausible path to being able to actually move progressive legislation. To arrive at that strategy can occasionally mean backing less than ideal Democrats if it means the control of the body is in play. You know, we think that the difference between a Democratic-controlled state Senate versus a Republican-controlled state Senate is a big enough deal that a mediocre Democrat might earn our support over a terrible Republican if the control of the, you know, the body as a whole is in play, and if we think we can make that upgrade, even if we don't, you know, ourselves subscribe to every, you know, every belief by a Democrat running in a swing district. I'm not sure that that's an approach that, you know, DSA would take. And I think that's, you know, that's it's good that there's, you know, a multiplicity of organizations doing different things. But my view would be if you look strategically at power, there are sometimes reasons to back candidates. Other than the candidates themselves.
That very well sets up my next question, which is the decision that WFP took that I think sparked the most criticism of the sort of charging that WFP didn't have enough critical distance from the Democratic Party was its decision to endorse Andrew Cuomo's reelection campaign in New York over his progressive challenger, Zephyr Teachout. And I know that that is something that you've probably spent dozens of hours of your life talking about since. But can you lay out what happened there and what lessons were learned afterwards?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And I should note, I come into this conversation as the guy who initially reached out to Zephyr Teachout about getting in the governor's race as a Working Families Party candidate. You know, the background here for your listeners outside of New York who were living under a rock in 2014 and didn't hear about this or were doing other things with their lives was a powerful and kind of conservative Democratic governor who had been holding up some, you know, quote unquote social issues as his sort of his you know flag. He was, you know, embraced same-sex marriage pretty early on, while at the same time having a fairly right-wing attitude on fiscal issues and in particular on things like taxing the rich. And so the Working Families Party was in this position where staying out of the governor's race wasn't an option because the ballot line for the New York WFP depended on 50,000 votes in the governor's race. So what we decided to do was seek out an alternative candidate and force Cuomo to either to make some policy concessions to us or else be willing to run against him. Staying out of the race altogether wasn't an option. So what we did was recruited a candidate into the race, as Zephyr Teachout, a Fordham law professor and, you know, progressive activist who is now, you know, in the public eye, suing the Trump administration over the emoluments clause.
Yeah, it turns out
very good for
that's her. You know, key, that's her. That happens to be her core academic expertise.
Right. That's right. And is, you know, a really great progressive leader. Stepped up to sort of be the alternative candidate. Now that precipitated a pretty interesting series of events, which was that the Working Families Party actually had enough power that it forced Cuomo to come to the table and at least verbally make a series of policy commitments around raising the minimum wage to $15, around decriminalizing marijuana, around the State Dream Act, a number of progressive policies. And on top of that, he committed to a political program to make that happen, which was that he was going to help use his political muscle and vast treasury to elect a Democratic majority to the state Senate, which, except for, you know, about 2 years after 2008, has been in Republican control since essentially time immemorial. Do you want me to do a digression?
Yeah, if you could do a digression on the weird setup of the New York Senate. I don't think people outside of New York are aware, and it's just one of the most bizarre things.
It is pretty bizarre. So the Republicans in the New York State Senate retain control over the Senate to this day, even though a majority of members of the Senate are elected as Democrats, because of a group of breakaway senators who call themselves the IDC, or the Independent Democratic Caucus, who caucus with the Republicans in the Senate. And that's been sort of an ongoing problem for the last couple of cycles, though this year it's finally awoken, I think, a sufficient level of outrage.
And Cuomo's been seen as sort of preferring this arrangement.
Right. That's right. And so he's long been thought to prefer that setup because it's allowed him full control over what comes to his desk, because he is at the heart of any deal, whereas Democratic majorities in both houses of the legislature could potentially pass, you know, a tax increase on millionaires, and he would then be in the position of having to either sign or veto it. Instead, with a split government, he's able to kind of architect what comes to his desk and what doesn't, and keep anything that he wants away from his desk. So that being said, you know, Cuomo sent a video to the Working Families Party convention detailing this set of policy concessions and detailing his plan to help take over the, you know, win Democratic control of the state Senate. So the Working Families Party in New York is our most well-developed chapter. The state committee is the decision was in the hands of the WFP's state committee at the convention, which was a body of about 200 grassroots activist leaders who represent, you know, a lot of them were rank and file union members, activists in the fight for 15, members of community organizations, individual progressive activists who had been organizing their local Working Families Party chapters for, you know, for a decade.
So, and not, so that group not of a smoke, not a smoke filled boardroom.
Right. And so that group of 200 people is suddenly put in front of them, you know, the choice of, do we give ourselves a path to pass a $15 minimum wage with the Democratic State Senate, even though it means trusting Andrew Cuomo, or do we run against him with a principled candidate who we believe in, who probably won't win, probably won't have the resources to win, and then won't have the Democratic Senate or the governor bound by the promises that he made seeking the endorsement. So it was actually very contentious. You know, activists in the Working Families Party argued about it for days at this convention, and ultimately the side favoring supporting Cuomo in exchange for those policy concessions won narrowly. On the one hand, I'll say, you know, Cuomo's promise to help take back the state Senate turned out to be a lie.
Not
he actually
so much.
Didn't do very much to take back the state Senate. What he did instead was he created a fake party called the Women's Equality Party in an effort to siphon votes away from the Working Families Party, one letter off, and pumped millions of dollars into that instead. So Cuomo after, wow. you know, being forced to sort of make these massive concessions on policy that he didn't really believe in, went on the outright attack, having secured the Working Families Party ballot line, which is then, you know, under New York State election law, couldn't be rescinded. He had gotten what he wanted and went on the attack. And, you know, the only other thing that I'll say about that is some of those policy concessions that Cuomo promised and then that he lied about taking back the state Senate, some of those policy concessions we actually got anyway. And I think because of the power exhibited by the Working Families Party and Zephyr Teachout and by a rising sentiment on the left, you know, we have a $15 minimum wage in most of New York today with a, you know, compromise that you know, we didn't support, but that means that parts of upstate New York will only get to $12.50. We have a ban on hydrofracking. We have a sort of landmark free college program that, you know, some criticisms of the implementation and the specifics of the plan notwithstanding is a pretty big step. So it's an interesting place to be in where the party was widely seen as kind of making a fool's bargain with somebody who wouldn't keep their end of the deal, but the policy concessions that were at the heart of it, you know, that are ultimately changing lives for people, ultimately have lifted wages for millions of New Yorkers. Some of those actually came into effect, but, you know, we remain in this state of, it's very complicated with Governor Cuomo, even so. And, you know, there's, he's been forced to move to the left in some major ways because of the, you know, changed climate that you know, initial setup helped kind of precipitate.
I mean, just even politics aside, it's hard to imagine a more unappealingly vicious and Machiavellian character, but yeah, he's just like remarkable how that man operates. So as an organization though, how is WFP thought through? I mean, it, obviously there's staff, there's members, there's organizations that are affiliated, this really complicated and fraught experience.
Yeah. I mean, I would say among the state committee of the New York Working Families Party, you know, what to do in 2014 was a very close decision, and whether or not, you know, that group made the right decision is a debate that the members of that state committee are, you know, in many cases still arguing about and still, you know, figuring out how they would do it differently. I do think that, you know, in 2015, we had a national membership vote in the Democratic presidential primary, and 87% of our members favored Bernie Sanders in that race. And, you know, I think, that was a pretty clear show of where the bulk of the membership of the Working Families Party was, but, you know, it was also a different context. So I, you know, it's almost impossible to say what might happen the next time.
Sticking to New York politics for a moment, obviously, de Blasio is to Cuomo's left on most issues pretty decisively, but a lot of people on the left in New York City have been pretty deflated at best about de Blasio, I think, particularly when it comes to issues around reforming NYPD practices. And then also, I spoke to Eliza Featherstone about this a few months back. He's just really bad at politics in a lot of ways. What's your assessment of de Blasio's track record thus far? And I know WFP is like strongly behind him. So what would you say to my many listeners in New York City who are not huge fans of his a few years in?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about a couple of things in what you said. One is that he hasn't always been so good at touting accomplishments. You know, I think a lot of other political leaders, the universal pre-K accomplishment would be something that you would almost never hear the end of. You know, it's like a major program that is a genuinely new entitlement in the best sense of the word, a genuinely new benefit for millions of working families that they didn't have before. It saves people a tremendous amount of money. It's, you know, beneficial to early childhood education. He doesn't get a lot of credit for that. I think the role of the, you know, there's a couple of other pretty good wins that are, you know, meaningful and substantive that we're very proud of. I think the you know, general mindset of the Working Families Party is that we want to make material gains for people where we can, and we want to keep pushing. So on issues where, you know, where we have a disagreement with the mayor, you know, I don't think anybody at the WFP is shy about continuing to push him.
I want to talk lastly sort of about WFP's structure and trajectory. First, the structure question. If you could tell me a little bit about how individual members of WFP and organizational members or affiliates, how they both operate in terms of the governance of the organization, especially mm-hmm. a lot of grassroots liberals are moving pretty hard to the left. While we do have a lot of left-led labor unions, we also have a number who, despite the last few decades of the labor movement's utter decimation, still somehow think that establishment corporate-aligned Democrats are going to save them.
So the WFP is a home for progressive organizations, progressive unions, and also progressive individuals. We have statewide, you know, statewide governing bodies in about 14 states now, which generally comprise a mix of representatives of institutions with individuals. We have new local branches, which are sort of unstaffed, small budget, you know, member-led local groups at the city or county level, where small groups of WFP activists can, you know, become the local Working Families Party of a city or county around the country. And we have a national leadership body that is, you know, the Working Families Party National Committee that has representatives of major institutions that support the Working Families Party, of representatives from each of those states with, you know, chartered statewide committees, from each of the local branches. And then also we are currently adding a number of, you know, individual slots. And so, but our aim is to give individuals, you know, in their own communities, lots of ability, lots of tools and capacity for leadership to build the Working Families Party and own the Working Families Party in their own community.
And then lastly, I wanted to ask about fusion voting. And a lot of listeners probably aren't aware of what it is, but when WFP was founded in, what year was that?
1998. Yeah.
Its big idea was all about fusion voting, and that's no longer the case. Can you explain a little bit about?
Sure, that's right. So yeah, fusion voting in some states is known as cross endorsement. It is essentially just an election law that means that a minor party can. And a major party can endorse the same candidate. So the ultimate impact of that is you might go to vote in New York City. And when you go to vote, you'll see, you know, we were just talking about Mayor de Blasio. You'll see Mayor de Blasio appear on the Democratic line and again on the Working Families Party ballot line. And so we tell people when they vote on the Working Families Party ballot line, that's the way to send a message with your vote to say where you want that candidate to be on the issues that matter to you, from, you know, from affordable housing to, you know, to policing to, you know, economic development, right? So we ask voters in states like New York and Connecticut and Oregon to always look for the Working Families Party ballot line as the progressive stamp of approval right on your ballot. So that was the main kind of growth strategy, you know, that was the main, you know, electoral strategy of the Working Families Party for a big piece of our history. And as we began to expand, we looked at states where we thought that either had a rule like that or a similar one, or we thought we had a path to passing a law like that one. So in Oregon, we started organizing in 2006 in Oregon with a plan to change the law and pass fusion voting, which we saw as at that time, you know, necessary to build the Working Families Party. I think it was really the success of the Tea Party on the right that showed us the, you know, the limitation of our thinking, which was that the Tea Party was this force that wasn't on the ballot at all, that wasn't using the fusion voting system, but still behaved like and saw itself as a political movement that was taking on the both Democrats, who they saw as who they saw as an anathema, and Republicans, who they saw as too liberal for their tastes. And we looked at our own record and realized, especially in places like New York City, the city council races that I mentioned to you, a lot of our biggest victories had actually been in Democratic primaries that weren't really dependent on the reality of having a ballot line in the general election or not. So, you know, in New York City, which is an overwhelmingly Democratic city, when Mayor de Blasio is reelected, the votes on the Working Families Party line, you know, might be 5 or 6 or 8% of the vote, but it's not going to make a huge determinative difference on whether or not he becomes a mayor in a city as strongly Democratic as New York. So we realized that we didn't have to be so limited in our thinking to growing only where we had this, sort of quirky election law. It's, you know, the fusion system is a great tool, we think, and it, you know, existed all across the country a century ago. It was often used for allowing sort of urban industrial immigrant parties with rural populist farmer parties to work together on a common slate of candidates. And ultimately, you know, the two-party establishment and the big banks managed to ban fusion in most states because they thought it's too powerful a tool to allow different constituencies like, you know, white workers and immigrant, you know, native born workers and immigrant workers to work together, or freed slaves in the Reconstruction South, and, you know, rural white populists, right? It was so it was a really powerful election law for that was heavily used by the left until it was banned in most states. So that was the initial thinking, but we've since, you know, changed our strategies a lot and realized that it's not a sort of critical prerequisite for the WFP to grow. And it's really been in the last 2 years or so that we've started rapidly growing new WFP state chapters and local branches, you know, really all across the country.
Last question is, I was just having a conversation with a friend about this last night, which is, why should we not be incredibly depressed by how thin the national level left bench is?
I think the reason we shouldn't be depressed is because for two reasons. One, because we have no choice but to continue to fight for what we believe in. But two, we shouldn't be depressed because there is an undeniable new wave of activist energy of people who want to participate. So we may not have as many, you know, leading light senators. We may not have as many Bernies and Elizabeth Warrens as we wish we did, but we have an incredible number of people on the ground who are newly activated and more activated than ever, who see a path to leadership in politics and who have capacity for leadership. And that's what gives me a lot of hope.
All right. Joe Dinkin, thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
Joe Dinkin is the National Campaigns and Communications Director at the Working Families Party. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once flawlessly conveyed via emoji, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. This week, we're posting 3. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our Postmaster General is Christian Tyler. I also want to specially thank Patrick Rochley this week. I was just thinking about how critical it is, his help getting us into this studio at Brown University's library where we broadcast. So thank you. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And if it's an iTunes, leave us a review. Those reviews help put us in front of new listeners, which advances the cause of socialism in our lifetimes, however minutely. And last but not least, please find us on patreon.com and make a monthly contribution to keep this operation up and running. Even a few bucks is a huge help.